you get the sense that there were just people in the administration that grew tired of Elon's ways, and Elon grew tired of their ways, and this reached a head. And that was always the big question, is like, even with the best intentions, can you actually affect some kind of change in Washington?
By default, what he's taking on is so unbelievably game-changing and so insane that you need that little bit of crazy in you.
If life is a video game for Elon Musk, like, the ultimate boss battle is colonize Mars.
It's like, how come this one guy does 8 things and everybody else is struggling to do 1? I think that if we could actually figure that out, that would like change the country. I think the mega trend is that the nerds have inherited the earth, right? The richest people in the world are engineers. That's like where we've ended up.
What's interesting about this discussion is, I mean, you've been following, I kind of want to get into this off the bat because I saw some of your commentary from yesterday. I mean, it's tough to avoid, but everything that went down with freaking Elon and Trump, you're somebody who has written extensively about Elon. You have interviewed him. You follow this place extremely closely. Core Memory, right? That's the name of your new venture.
That's it.
You follow AI technology very closely as well. And as we all know, Elon is sort of like one of the big boys in that space. So high level.
And don't forget that he has the OG biography of
exactly.
Elon. So
yep. And we'll make sure to link all of that in the description in the comment section below for everybody to check out. Ashley is just like, he's just a monster. He's a beast. Wow. We're honored to have him on the podcast. But high level, what the hell is going on?
Well, I guess on the high level, I think we all could have seen this coming. You know, it was a matter of time. Ever since they kind of joined forces, yeah. You know, I mean, it seemed like they were using each other in ways that were helpful. But I always wondered how long. They're wired in pretty similar ways on a lot of things. And so it just felt like there was going to be a clash at some point, and, you know, just giant egos and giant desires and things like that. So some of this makes sense. I'm kind of surprised it took as long as it did in a lot of ways. I did not think, I don't know, you know, that it was actually looking like it was going pretty well through these first 100 days and they were really close. It seems like, as far as I can read the tea leaves, you know, Elon's, this is not going to be a secret to anyone. He's very opinionated. He ultimately is concerned about these broader issues like the country and humanity and all that, but is going to focus on what he thinks is the right thing for him to do and what he wants. And so, you know, you get the sense that there were just people in the administration that grew tired of Elon's ways, and Elon grew tired of their ways, and this reached a head. It's really sad to see how it's playing out, though, not just the like tit for tat on X, but, you know, I think the tweet or the post you were talking about was probably about Jared Isaacman. And, you know, he would have been the best thing to happen to NASA in a long, long time. And I think most people probably agreed on that. And he was not like some SpaceX Elon lackey, even though he's been on their rides. You know, I think he's a stand-up guy who'd sort of proven that he's just interested in space and would do the right thing. So anyway, sorry, long-winded answer. It's just really sad to see the fallout from this end up being the usual sort of gross Washington politics where somebody has a grudge against Elon and decides to take Jared out as a result of that.
Yeah, it's a bummer. And by the way, don't be afraid to take it as long as you want. We're super curious to see how you're thinking through this, honestly. I think what's interesting about this in this juncture is, you know, like, for those of us like myself, I would categorize this like I do feel like Elon is a forcing function towards optimization of civilization in a lot of different respects. And the way he approaches Tesla, SpaceX, Neuralink, et cetera, is sort of an encapsulation in that. And that's in the engineering world. That's in the science world. That's in the business world. And my one hope was, okay, so now he's got his eyes set on the government stuff. He's got his eyes set on, okay, now let's do that same Musk method, whatever we want to call it, and apply it to government. But it does feel like that the two-headed monster of, you know, the Democrats, Republicans, the way Congress is built,
the way swamp politics, is winning.
it feels like the swamp is winning. So how do you have any commentary there? Any thoughts you'd like to share?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I saw the Jared thing, yeah, my first thought was, the swamp is back. I thought Trump was anti-swamp.
Yeah.
this looks very swampy. I mean, look, man, the same thing. You know, I think everybody watching this knew going in that there would be major conflicts between Elon's methods and Washington's methods, because they couldn't be more opposite. And that was always the big question, is like, even with the best intentions, can you actually affect some kind of change in Washington? Clearly, Elon's been doing this thing, not just since the X days, but a bit before. I mean, you know, his modus operandi now is to kind of come in, break a lot of things, see what's essential, and then try to, you know, he is willing to bring back things if he's broken them too far. And in the case of Twitter, I remember the mass hysteria in the first week or so after he took it over, and everyone's like, oh, this whole thing's going to fall over. He's firing 70% of the employees, it'll never work. And, you know, it turns out it works pretty well. And I don't know what those 70% of the people were doing. And you have the sense, okay, we're going to try that in government. A lot of people are going to get upset. I suspect the backlash Elon received was worse than he thought. I mean, you saw what was happening to Tesla. You saw Elon's, at this point, I think, used to being a polarizing figure and being loved by some and hated by others. But I think it was probably worse than he thought. And there were real consequences to that. I think Washington I know they're just allergic to a bunch of really smart 20-year-olds running around telling people how to do things better.
And, that's so depressing.
But you know, I mean, there is always the larger question.
Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Rebellion Air. We know that a lot of you in our audience are big-time Tesla investors, but just because you're willing to make a big bet on a single company, that doesn't mean that you don't think about how to manage your risk to the downside. And let's face it, once that big concentrated Tesla position grows to be worth $1 million or more, it can definitely be a good time to bring in some professional help. But who can you hire that isn't going to give you cookie cutter advice or scold you for not being diversified enough? That's where Rebellion Air can help. Bradford Ferguson and Matt Smith are big time retail investors like you, and they've done tons of unique and insightful research around things like Tesla's FSD and energy, so they understand exactly where your conviction comes from. But they're also professionals, and through Rebellion Air, they specialize in helping investors like you with big concentrated investments to protect yourself from the downside risk while growing your share count over time using strategies like trimming and adding or covered calls. Not only that, but they can also help you to create a money master plan from your financial first principles. If that sounds interesting to you and you've got a $1 million position or more in a company like Tesla, you can head on over to rebellionair.com/Farzad using the link in the description to let them know that we sent you. That's rebellionair.com/Farzad. And now, back to the podcast.
It's like, can a government sort of be run like an efficient company? And I think that's like still an open question. I think what's clear is, you know, like the US is just on a point of no return. I mean, my biggest thought, one of the All In podcast guys tweeted what was on my mind, which is China won. You know, I think we're just like full of self-distraction and getting in our own way at a time when we need to be very focused and have a plan and be moving forward collectively.
Yeah. I think that post came from Friedberg, I believe, because I saw the same one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's interesting about that, and I agree with you, it does feel like we're at a point of no return. It feels like one of the people that would be best equipped, it feels like, at least from a execution perspective, the public persona and the communication perspective notwithstanding, and maybe that's the bigger piece of this, is like maybe the lesson here is, doesn't matter how talented you are from an execution perspective, if you don't have that image thing cleaned up, then the monster will eat you. Right. And the monster being the swamp, Washington, whatever we want to call it. So it's almost like and what's interesting about that, too, is Elon posted that, you know, while he was going, you know, scorched earth on Trump, he put that poll where he's like, is it time for a third party to actually legitimately go in and sort of challenge the GOP and the Democrats? And 81% of his audience voted yes. And you would think that from the, you know, from the last couple years of the last few months of going super MAGA and all these people coming to his side, I was a little bit surprised by seeing that big of a result, which kind of tells me there's still sort of this like independent centrist thing attached to Musk, which is like, it's not a hardline MAGA. It's like, let's actually focus on what's important here. And the real big focus is the deficit. Do you think this gives a pathway for a legitimate third party movement in the coming years that is sort of inspired by Elon and sort of headed by Elon? Does that, do you think that weighs at all? Do you think this is like, we're just going to wait for Rome to collapse and build around it? Like how?
Yeah.
How do you think about it?
I think stuff like that just gets at the heart of what we all know, which is most people are kind of in the middle and they want to be happy. They want to be nice to each other. They want things to get done. And most of the stuff we see out there is just these polarizing ends of that. I don't know. I used to work at Bloomberg when Mike Bloomberg was going to run for office. I actually got excited. You know, I mean, he's a guy that kind of leans left socially. I think I probably do too. And then he leans right fiscally. And I think I probably do too. Just having worked at Bloomberg and seeing him as mayor, I know he upset some people, but clearly he got a lot of things done and was like a smart, practical person. So I had always hoped he would run independent. He has all the money in the world. So clearly there are reasons you don't take that option, because it's almost impossible to actually make headway in the elections because of the way our system's set up. Just because Elon wants something and all these people voting and this thing want something, I'm also afraid. I just don't even know if it's possible or practical to achieve with the way things are set up. At some point, my entire life, we've been debating like the same things. It's like abortion and gun rights, while China has set this like 40-year plan of science and ambition and industry. And, it's like, how long are we going to do this? I mean, are we going to talk about something else? Are we going to fix some things or not? And even Trump, right? I mean, when he, like, I was not a big Trump fan at all, especially the first time around.
Yeah.
But when he came in and he was like talking about, I'm going to clean out the swamp and all that stuff, I actually kind of believed him, right? Because it's like, why not, man? that's like what you've run on. It's not like, you know, if anyone was willing to take that chance, it seemed like it would be him. And so, you know, clearly this is very hard, or there's not much motivation to change.
Yeah, especially with the coalition that he built around him too, right? That was like the sort of like, wow, this is, and you know, he survived the shooting and everything. I'm like, okay, so that something must have changed. Something has to have changed, and maybe we are actually getting to a point where we are, instead of going the typical route, which is black swan event happens, we respond. It's like, okay, we see all the data, let's fix it. But now it's like, after the events of the last few days, it's like, okay, yeah, no, we're back to black swan event has to happen and then something will change, but we have to survive the black swan first.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, you know.
And then for the third party, you know, because you were talking about sort of the person who's at the head of all this, you know, obviously they have to be charismatic and have a message people are buying into. I mean, I think Elon was always going to be too complicated we've like lost any sense of nuance around him in the public sphere a long time ago. And that's the other question, is like, who would this third party person be? You have to be enough of a character to be interesting and to get stuff done, but you have to be that person without baggage that's gonna undermine everything. I'm never sure if this person exists.
Yeah, I thought that was Trump. The second time around, at least. And execution leaves a lot to be desired anyway. Hans,
yeah, like,
yeah, sorry, Ashley, go.
No, you go.
Yeah,
well, I was just going to. This is not, you know, my idea. I was kind of looking at different people's opinions of what's going on and have been seeing some speculation that, you know, one of the interesting dynamics around Elon is that he is, you know, operating this wholly owned factory in China. And that is aligned with some of the strategic objectives of the CCP. But he's also close to Trump. And like, that's a very fraught situation to have to navigate in a time when we're renegotiating, you know, the entire global trade system. And so there are some people that are speculating that maybe this whole thing is just a show to reduce China's leverage over the negotiations, or over like maybe the fallout for Tesla due to the negotiations. I mean, I have no idea if there's any legitimacy to this idea, but do you think there's possibility to that? Like, how does that theory and speculation strike you?
Yeah, stranger things have happened, certainly in the realm of possibility. I haven't heard that one yet. I'm thinking it through while you're talking.
Welcome to Conspiracy Corner.
I mean, this one just strikes me as I've sort of seen this play out. This is not it's not the first time Elon's been through this kind of thing with somebody, you know, and so I don't know. There's a lot of familiar hallmarks that make me think. I don't know. The second that they linked forces, I figured it was kind of two things. One was Elon wanted to get revenge on Biden because Biden was so stupid in the way he treated both Tesla and SpaceX and Elon more generally. And then two, you know, Elon actually cares about this. He's got this like patriotic streak. And I think he saw Trump as a means to an end to get things done that he wanted to get done. So all that sort of made sense. But I actually thought it would kind of implode within days. You know, once one person started getting more attention than the other, especially once Trump got into office and people were meeting like he's the puppet president for Elon. I thought that would be the end. So I was shocked that we got this far. So I don't know, man. That's an interesting conspiracy. I don't know if I've run the full calculus on that one yet. That one's harder for me to believe in this moment. But possible, I suppose.
What got lost because of the interaction is, you know, talked about the patriotic streak and all that stuff. I do think the unfortunate reality is that the centerpiece of the disagreement, which is the debt and the deficit, completely lost in this shit show. Completely and utterly lost. And it has been, you know, when one of the things I try to do, you know, before I sort of start covering some of this stuff is I do try to ingest the entire media landscape as broadly as I can to understand sort of what the vibe is. Like, how are people perceiving this? Are they root cause analyzing this, right? And when every single time, this is my disappointment with, and I don't know if I should be even surprised or, because I feel like this is a tale as old as time. In the game of media, you lead with the thing that grabs the eyeballs, and then you attach some sort of emotion to it, and you try to keep the people engaged by driving that emotion. And in this entire kerfuffle, whatever you want to call it, the entire premise of the discussion has been completely and utterly lost. And even with publications that I listen to on a daily basis, shout out Two Way is one of the huge ones that I listen to from a politics perspective. Even then, the focus was, well, I wonder what's going to happen with the relationship between Trump and Elon. I wonder what's going to happen with that stuff. And like, but then the broader theme of, guys, $36 trillion in debt, completely lost. Completely lost, right? And so it's this.
Yeah. Elon... I think probably takes some of the blame there because, you know, the second he tweeted out the Epstein files stuff, I mean, the media, everybody's going to, once it became this tit for tat personal thing between the two of them, then everybody's going to shift their focus. And, you know, it's been like a long running thing since Elon got more active on X. It's kind of fascinating. I mean, he's wielded this tool in many ways exceptionally well. I mean, you know, he's gotten more and more power. He's able to sway the public to his thinking, but because he sometimes veers into this more personal stuff, he, you know, undermines a lot of things as well. If Elon could go from like 11 to like 7, you know, I think he would do himself some favors.
Do you think we're at a point now where, you know, because this is something that gets discussed a lot with Tesla investors, and obviously you've covered Elon extremely closely. We've known him for a really long time. So one of the fundamental things that we've come to just accept, you know, it's like you kind of have a you know, our firstborn was born a year ago. We've had a kid for about a year. But one of the things that I'm developing is like just not even developing. I've had for a long time. Unconditional love under any circumstance. It doesn't matter. Like, you're my son. I love you so much. Right. And I think what's interesting about the Elon thing is like, OK, it's obvious that this guy is like the best leader for his companies by far. Nobody can come close because by default, what he's taking on is so unbelievably game changing and so insane that you need that little bit of crazy in you. So it's like, what is the likelihood that Elon will ever go from 11 to 7? I feel like that 11 is built into his persona. The writing that you've done, the writing of Walter Isaacson, I think has reconfirmed that. Do you agree with that sentiment? How do you think about that?
I agree. And then, but you know, it's like the same. This is like ancient wisdom, right? Like your best traits are sometimes your worst traits as well. Yeah. And the things that make you successful sometimes undermine you. So, you know, that's the way he's always been, man. I remember when I was doing my book, you know, and it's like you write about all these stories where SpaceX and Tesla are near bankruptcy. And then by the time my book's coming out, SpaceX is like kind of starting to hit its stride. It's doing very well. The Model S is selling so much better than I think even Tesla and Elon probably expected. And you're like, oh, there's finally like some calm in the universe, you know. And then every single time that happens, I mean, he just immediately goes all in. And, you know, it's like, we're betting everything on the Model 3. We're gonna push this company, you know, back to the edge again. And so I actually think this is part of what,
he gets so much done so quickly. But yeah, like, you have to be right on the edge of it might fail in order to move that quickly at that scale.
And I think you get on it. This is my observation over time, especially from the Elon I knew when I first started writing the book, is that I think there becomes an addiction to that feeling. I think there becomes an addiction to like the high of achievement, right? Because even Elon's entry into media and politics, you're kind of like, why? You've got so much going on. Things are going well. It's not like he had some shortage of ambitious things to do, but you know, I think you, it's kind of like, okay, I've done that. Now I want to feel what this is like. And I want, he went from, when I first met him, he was still, you know, his companies were doing okay, but they were really just like starting to kind of like get out of a pretty like long funk of under, not underachieving, but struggling to like get their footing. And you know, he was still pretty, I think he's always been immensely confident in his intellect, but you could feel some insecurity in his personality, just as like you know, around people. I think he probably thought, okay, I'm a successful business person, but I'm not nearly as successful as my friends Larry and Sergey and Jeff. You know, he wasn't even anywhere near like one of the richest people in the world. And you could kind of feel some of that. And then as the company started to do better, you felt this like confidence come. He got a little bit less shy. Then he started to kind of, he moved to LA. He's kind of courting celebrity. He starts to get okay being in the public sphere. And then obviously he becomes this massive celebrity, and he's just kind of leaned into all this. You know, the businesses have done fantastically well. His celebrity's rising, and then his influence around the world is rising. I think you need to, what else are you going to do, man? Once you felt that, you want to feel that stuff again. And now it's like, where's the bar? Because you saw him as Doge was wrapping up, you could tell what was happening, right? He's like going back to SpaceX. He's signaling to everybody, hey, I've got my eye on the businesses again. I'm going to pay attention to this stuff for a while. And I think even we can feel like, oh, that's like some kind of step back. Is that going to be fully satisfying or not, you know? And so I kind of don't, it's not like I blame it, but I think this is it's something that can be self-defeating.
I think that's very interesting commentary, and I agree with you. I do think Elon, and I think I mentioned this before in previous podcasts, I do think he's a dopamine junkie in a lot of different ways. I think the dopamine of it's not even the maybe the fame, but of solving extremely difficult problems where you can quantify the result of that problem being solved and being like, holy shit, look at how big of an impact this is. And of course, everything else that comes along with it, even the fame, sort of this totality, sort of harkens back to the sort of the stuff that has been written around him, where he views, you know, life as more of a video game. You know, he views life as a sort of thing that can be solved in a lot of different ways. And every time he achieves a certain level of success in solving for those things, then to your point, holy shit. Okay, now I need something bigger than that for me to fill that dopamine void, like that dopamine thing that I achieved before. But to your point, like, okay, at some point, it feels like life is kind of finite. You know, at some point, you can only get so big because we're confined by the size of the Earth. So maybe that's where the Mars thing comes in. Maybe Mars is his outlet valve.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's what I was going to say here is that, you know? Like, if life is a video game for Elon Musk, like, the ultimate boss battle is colonize Mars. And so I think where we are now is still, you know, what, not even the halfway point. Like, this is a very dramatic end to an exciting intro. If you view the end game as colonizing Mars, we've still got a long way left to go. So I guess, yeah, when you really think about the implications of building an industry and companies that reach the type of scale that is capable of putting millions of humans on the face of Mars, like, there's a lot of very tectonic things that have to happen between here and there.
Yeah. And I think probably trying to reshape America and redirect its course was probably, you know, it's actually kind of like on that scale, right? Especially something you could do in the near term. I mean, you're trying to fix Rome, you know,
and the two things are related.
Process. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And yeah, because Mars gives you the clean slate, but this is, I mean, it's so funny. People Elon's a complicated dude. It frustrates me that he gets reduced to like this, I hate him, I love him kind of thing. You know, he's got this weird, I get asked all the time, it's like, does he care about money? Is that what this is all about? I do find that like comical, because there's just like not a lot of, does he like money? Like, sure. You know, and does he like his lifestyle? Does his money afford him power and things like that? But it's pretty hard to like look at the track record and sort of decide that he was making rational decisions to maximize his wealth at various periods, you know. But it's like, what does he actually care about? And, you know, is he great on like person to person interactions? Not really, but he does for sure have this thing that I don't think most people have on the level he does, of this like empathy for humanity, because people will say, well, he's a jerk to a lot of people, but then he does like for sure have this empathy for the human species. And when he talks about this like United States stuff, I don't think it's like at all bullshit or anything, man. I mean, I think he like feels this on this like pretty deep level. He actually cares about it. You might disagree with the way he goes about it or what he cares about, but like fundamentally he wants the US to succeed. And so, I think the mission of trying to right the country was just like Mars is probably like an existential type thing for him.
Exactly. The existentialism that he applies to everything he does, like every venture, I think that's the common thread, is like SpaceX, existential. Why? Because if we don't go to Mars, we all die. Tesla, existential. Why? Because if we don't solve for renewable energy consumption and generation, we all die, right? It's like Neuralink is more about merging with AI, but that's existential, because if AI gets too powerful and we don't merge with AI, we all die, or we could have a high chance of dying. So it's like this
making babies.
Yeah, you know, tunnels. Not as existential, although traffic can suck.
I saw somebody with a good tunnel theory that I hadn't thought of, which seems like so obvious now. Like, because it definitely. I remember when the tunnel stuff was happening, and I was talking to Elon a lot back then, and it was like traffic, and I think he saw that as like a existential thing because he was living in LA and it was ruining his time. But yeah, somebody was talking about, oh, well, you know, if you go to colonize Mars, you're probably going to want to do a lot of stuff underground. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. I was like, I was actually embarrassed. I hadn't sort of thought that one through yet, but I think it's part of that, part of the grand vision.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're all those things, you know, all his ventures are Mars beta in a lot of different ways, and getting Mars beta figured out on Earth then allows us sort of to jump to Mars. And then as he removes the blockades to try to get to Mars by, you know, increasing cadence of Starship through removing of regulation, ensuring that the United States is still a safe harbor for business by ensuring it doesn't collapse up, onto itself, right? Et cetera, et cetera. Then that becomes the final boss battle. So fascinating stuff. Hans, let me bring you in because I know that you have a few questions on your end. So make sure get a tip.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on, do we want to leave this topic and really move to one of, you know, I've been following you for a long time, Ashley, and you've always been very interested in, you know, interesting personalities. So obviously that was why you gravitated towards Elon early on. And you found him at a time when most of the rest of the world was, you know, semi-interested in him, but not at the level, obviously, that he became. And so you kind of see these seeds of potential in people ahead of time, and you kind of go down these obsessive rabbit holes. So what is it that fascinates you about people? And then you can tell that story through the lens of Elon, or you could also maybe weave in some of the other people that you've been obsessively reporting on over the last 10 years as well.
Yeah, anyway, well, that's kind of you to follow my work and then super insightful, I think. It's hard to put into words a little bit. But yeah, I mean, that's been, I don't think I like set out with a whole master plan of how to do this. I was just kind of tech reporting and getting interested in tech, and then just kind of kept getting drawn to pretty eccentric people. And then over time, it's obvious to me, yes, I have some fixation with, I think I like people who live, I like people who've kind of like created their own rules for whatever universe they're choosing to live in, and who are like very convicted on some path through life that strikes me as a bit unusual or off center. And it's funny because like a lot of people are like, oh, you're like a techno optimist or something like that. I think I have a genuine interest in and curiosity around technology, and I'm certainly like kind of pro innovation, but I always think this comes from somewhere else. Like in my writing is just that I just don't think I'm judgmental. You know, I don't think any of us have life figured out. I don't really think there's like one true way to live. And so even if Elon rubs you the wrong way or Brian Johnson or whoever, I sort of don't care. I just think it's interesting that there are people who choose to, it's almost like performance art, I guess, just live their life as like a thing, as opposed to just going through the motions. And so that's what I get into. And then I seem to have like, I've never really covered consumer technology. I've always been drawn to like the engineers and the scientists and everything. And so that seems to put me like 5 years ahead of generally like where things are going. And then I'm always running this calculus in my head of like, is it 5 years or is it like 15? As far as like, it's easy to write magazine stories about just about anything and explore them in a momentary thing. But if you're trying to pick a book or a movie, something you're going to commit years of your life to, and selfishly, you're trying to time it so that lots of people read it or watch it. Like it has to be a commercial success. You need that thing to actually be out in the world. You know, like on Elon, you're totally right. I mean, people had done all these feature stories on him when he had launched Tesla and SpaceX. And for a while, it was like, oh, PayPal guys, like off chasing these huge ambitious things. And then it took a long time. So then people are like, oh, it's the dude who promises stuff and never delivers. And then by the time, you know, I was starting to get really interested in him, it was like, oh, this stuff's kind of working. Like SpaceX got to the ISS with Dragon and the Model S was coming. And when I went to pitch a magazine story on him. He'd sort of scorched the earth. All the magazine people were like, no, we've been there, done that. And I was like, no, but it's like working now. And they were like, not interested. And then I kept getting interested. And then, like you said, I mean, it was like one of the most fortuitous things in my life, I guess. I was just like, dude, I think there's a book here. And by the time I finished, stuff was really starting to click. So yeah, I don't know. You just have to, you got to try to find that balance, but I think that's it. I think I'm just interested in eccentric people. I find it more, it's like, what am I going to do? Being a reporter doesn't generally pay very well. So you might as well like enjoy what you're doing and hang out with fascinating people. That's really what I like to do is watch people do. I guess I'm a voyeur professionally.
So, you know, in reflecting on the people that you've covered, because you've covered a lot of obviously huge successes, not just Elon, but, you know, Peter Beck and what he's done with Rocket Lab has been obviously incredible. A number of others as well. But you've also covered, you know, a number that ended up kind of going nowhere. Are there any common traits that you can maybe, like, what separates the people who are able to actually bring that vision of a different world into existence versus the ones who, you know, have grand ambition and eccentricity and boldness, but end up not being able to actually deliver the goods?
Yeah, it's like hard to answer universally because I think there are some, I think a lot of it is timing and luck and just like I'm trying to time my book or something. Sometimes you have a good idea, but it's just in the wrong spot at the wrong time. And maybe you have the wrong set of people around you to help make it happen. I would say, so there's some of that. I mean, I see a lot of times I get drawn to academics and I find them fascinating because they're brilliant and they do weird things. Most often they tend to be quite poor business people and really need someone around them who can help shape that part I've seen play out again and again. And I usually can, I've done this long enough. I don't want to claim I'm like some genius, but I can usually feel that pretty clearly in the room where it's like, oh, you have awesome ideas and you're fascinating, but I've got a pretty clear sense this is not going to work. Another character trait is like the people who just cannot, they just cannot give in on the perfection of it all. And like the company has to be, you know, just exactly
the classic engineer's trap.
Yeah. And there's like a business version of that. And there's, you know, I know a guy who he's like one of the world's best pizza makers. And, you know, he was trying to make a frozen pizza brand. It would have been great, right? Like he's slaving away in a pizza shop every day. And he was trying to make life a little easier on him. And he had people who would back him. And, you know, it took like 3 years or something to get the frozen pizza, you know, and it's like, yes, you want it to be high quality. You want it to be great. But it's like, he just couldn't give in on anything. He ended up shipping them like all vegetarian. It's like, dude, some people like pepperoni on their pizza, like a lot of people do, you know? And so I don't know, just that inability to make, like, I think Elon is actually an example of someone who clearly like very fixated on the end goal, but like is willing to make compromise and change things to get there, you know? And I think some people don't have that. The other side is, I don't think it's any big secret, man. It's just hard work. You know, if you think about Peter, if you think about Elon, even if you think about someone like Brian Johnson or what he's doing. I mean, it's just like obsessive devotion to what you're trying to do. There's huge trade-offs. You're going to have less time with your family. You're going to like not sleep as much as you should. That it's kind of like the one thing, it drives me, you know, I think about someone like Larry Page, and I remember interviewing him for the Elon book, and he's like, man, I wish I could be like Elon. I mean, he can just like try anything and go off and do it. And at that time, I think Larry was worth like $28 billion. And I think Elon was probably worth like, I don't know, $600 or $700 million. So I found all this quite confusing. It was sort of like, well, you're sort of the dude who could really do anything. Like, what do you mean? And then, you know, in the years that have followed, Larry has started a bunch of like flying car companies, all kinds. He's had some secret incubator in Silicon Valley trying all sorts of ideas, but you don't see them come to fruition. And it's like, well, why? Or look at Blue Origin, right? Sort of limitless resources, full of smart people. You know, the difference, I'm pretty sure, is that, like, at some point Elon's like on the factory floor sleeping there yelling at people to get stuff done. And if you're not willing to, like, if you're the figurehead and you're not willing to kind of like actually dig in, it's just not going to get where you want. You know, Peter's the same way. So it is funny though. Sorry, I'll stop babbling in 1 second. But you know, when I was doing this last book called When the Heavens Went on Sale, it was really interesting. So I ended up writing about 4 companies, but I followed like 10, especially rocket startups. And most of those rocket startups were based in the US. Most of them had a lot of SpaceX veterans. And so by all rights, it's kind of like, oh, we know how to build rockets. You guys have all these veterans, you've got money, you should all kind of like end up somewhere similar. And then it turned out the Rocket Lab, the company in New Zealand with nobody that had ever made a rocket before, a CEO who didn't go to college, a country with no aerospace experience, like outflanked all of those and became the thing that looked the closest to SpaceX. And so then you're like, well, why do Rocket Lab and SpaceX make it? And like all these other companies got stuck. And, you know, the only thing I can come back to is this culture that gets set from the top, and that it must have some kind of bearing on the company.
I think that's such a fascinating observation. So I worked at Tesla from 2017 to 2021. I've been a Tesla investor since 2012. And before I joined the company, my thing was that really attracted me to that story was the leader's capability of setting a grand vision that would be easy to buy into if you're passionate about it. And then when I joined the company, what I was really shocked by was just how that culture permeated through the building. And it didn't matter what building I was in, every single person, but I mean, outside of the bottom 10, 20%, whatever you want to call, when I say every single person, I mean, the folks that will make it there from year to year, right? The reason why they made it is because the mission was very easy to identify, and it was very easy to see how valuable it is for the long term. And then there was an empowerment of the staff to go and get that thing. Right? It's complete trust. Like, the reason why you're here, you're here because we trust you and because you're capable. Here are the keys to the business. Go. And then when you're turning the key, you know that the end goal in the case of Tesla is advancing the world to a sustainable future. It's like, and so my head went to, it's like, okay, how much do you increase the chance of success of a company if you're able to identify that existential mission? Because that existential mission is the thing that sets the culture. How do you think about that?
Well, I think you're spot on. I mean, that's clearly like what is Elon's greatest talent, right? It's attracting young, brilliant people and setting them on this mission. I mean, it's sort of mind-boggling that people kind of miss this, you know, and it's not easy, right? Because like otherwise people would do this. I mean, I think there has to be some kind of like authenticity in it, you know. I mean, what's clear from Elon is all the stuff we talked about, this kind of desperation, this existential angst. It's not, you're not just like putting lipstick on a pig or writing some marketing slogan. I mean, that's why it's bleeding down, you know. And Peter Beck is like, he's a little less existential, but he's like, engineering is his life. Like, this thing has to work. It has to look good. It has to be good. And like the bar is exceptionally high, and you can feel that. You see companies have picked up on this and they try to lurch around and put that brand, that thinking on there. I think about this a lot, right? So I was at a conference full of like the masters of the universe about a year ago, and I don't think I'm allowed. I'm trying to remember the rules on this thing. Anyway, it was a bunch of billionaires and scientists and all people you would know. And you know, there were a couple of them up on stage, and they're like, you know, we kind of, when you look at Elon, even if you freaking hate him, I mean, you cannot deny there's like no one. If you look at the last 25 years, it is absurd what he has accomplished. I honestly don't think there's anything like it in history, and definitely not in the last 100 years. And then, you know, they're sort of like, we need, if we just had like six of him or 20 of him, you know, this country, it's like, it's kind of like, why don't we? Because he did become this sort of like idolized figure. And you see all these, whether it's like defense startups or manufacturing stuff, you know, hard tech startups, everyone wants to be like Elon. They're all trying to do this stuff. It's like, how come this one guy does eight things and everybody else is struggling to do what? I think that if we could actually figure that out, you know, that would like change the country. But it's like maybe there can only be one at a time. I don't know. I guess I vaguely think of Steve Jobs, but he kind of did, you know, he did computing and movies and I don't know. It's just not the same.
Yeah. I always think it's funny when people just say, oh, you know, Elon, the only reason he's been able to accomplish all this stuff is because he just hires smart people.
Right.
And they do it for him. It's like, you have obviously never tried to manage even one smart person. If you think you can make a smart person do what you want him to do instead of what he wants him to do, like, it's just the hardest thing in the world. I can't even make me do what I want to do. And so like his ability to marshal that many different smart people who are all so smart in so many different areas, and he does, you know, set them off on this mission. And it's a combination, I think, Farzad, to add one more dimension, not just that the mission is that great, but also he's able to earn the respect of these people that do this work because of his work ethic, but also his ability to learn their area of expertise and have like value added conversations to like help them understand how their part fits into the larger whole and get to a very, very high level of understanding of what it is that they're doing very, very quickly. And I think that is one of the reasons why it's so hard for anyone else to do this, because I don't know how many, like, is that a 1 in 100 billion like humans that can get to the ability to have a legitimate conversation with top people in their field across 100 different disciplines of science and engineering. Like, that's just such a hard thing.
It's interesting too, because it actually like seems to multiply as the years have gone on. I remember I was in Neuralink in their semiconductor factory, you know, and I mean, Elon sometimes plays this dangerous game where you're totally right. You know, it's like he can talk in depth about how the brain works all the way, obviously, to rocket, you know, astrophysics and things like that. However, you know, sometimes you're in a field like semiconductors and you're like, well, this guy's got a PhD in this. He's done this for 20 years. Semiconductors are pretty hard. I know, you know, like a lot about how semiconductors work, but maybe you shouldn't be giving advice. But like on this particular thing, you know, they were, I forget which part, but it was being made out of some metal and it was expensive and the process was difficult. And you know, Elon just kept stressing to this guy, he's just like, you just cannot make it out of that because we want to make 10 million of these implants one day. And this is just like not a path to get there. And you could, you know, and I could feel the frustration from the semiconductor guy where he's like, well, you can't make it any other way. And then Elon being like, well, then this is a pointless, you have to, because otherwise this is a pointless exercise. And you could tell that semiconductor dude had never been put in the position where he had to think about mass manufacturing, anything, definitely not a consumer electronics device. And so Elon was saving an incredible amount of time where it was like, okay, well, either we do it or we don't, because you just can't do it this way. And, you know, he knew enough to like, to see all these steps down the future. And then if you think about it, he's like the only person who's built this many different factories and products ranging from like rockets to kind of consumer electronics devices. So you have all this pattern matching that just like nobody else has. Right. And so it's kind of, it's benefiting him. But I think you, I think about Jeff Bezos. I mean, he knows rockets as well, if not like maybe even better than Elon, in some sense, you know, and obviously knows retail better than and e-commerce better than probably anyone. I do think there are people that can like hang across these different fields. It's just, you're right. I'm sure it's not like hundreds of thousands of people, but it's like, I think there are others. And then it's just the matter of like, can you actually implement that somehow?
Yeah. And I do wonder if it's like, it's just like, it's a genetic thing with pain tolerance and neuroplasticity, where it's like, there are folks that can match them, let's say on the IQ engineering thing, where they can be peers and or greater than Elon when it comes to special areas of expertise. But Elon's secret weapon is that, like we're talking about, is like now he can do that across, like there's no limit to the horizontal, right? He can go across anything, and the pain tolerance he has to dig deep, run into walls, bang his head against a wall. Okay, let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. Let's learn it this way. Let's learn it that way. You know, oh, like there's never a, this is too hard. There is never a, this is too painful. It's like, no, it has to get done. And like, and then my brain goes to, okay, that existential nature that he has, like his anxiety for this to not get done, otherwise the species dies, is the forcing function to just barrel through those walls. And it's like, how many people are like, okay, fuck, like I want to go hang out with my wife. Like, this is crazy. I want to go hang out with my kid.
Yeah. It's like most people just don't care about things that much. And yeah, you know, his concerns might not even be rational, but he's committed to them. So it's like, yeah, you know, yeah. Can you imagine? Like, I think about sometimes what his life must be like. I mean, he must get, I bet on like an average day, I bet he gets, you know, he probably gets what? I don't know. 200 to 400 requests from a bunch of the most important people in the world asking for favors, like day after day after day after day, and then asking to fix. Like, even just since I started this company, my life used to be relatively simple. It's like I was doing my reporter work and stuff, and you know, I just have like a bunch of incoming stuff. And as you get some level of like a media presence, it's like, you know, I have people knocking on my door all the time, and it's like overwhelming. You don't want to say no, but you know, you don't have the time to do this stuff. And you know, whatever level he is on of that must be like, I mean, probably this is why sometimes he flies into like his fits of rage. It's probably like unsustainable and really hard to handle, you know?
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that is actually like.
Yeah. And then in tandem with that, you know, and, you know, I know you and I, and obviously everybody else who has a business faces this, like at some point there's an existential thing you have to deal with the business. And then there, he's doing that across 7 or 8 different organizations. And then every day it's just a cycle of bullshit, of just shit that's breaking all the time. And then unless you step in and fix it, plus all the external factors that are coming in. I mean, I really do think he is a haunted individual. I think his brain at this point, it's like, I don't think he's a happy person. Unfortunately, I think he's a good person. I think he's got a good soul. I'm super thankful that he exists, but I cannot imagine that he is happy. I don't think he's happy.
I don't think so. And I think for quite a while now, he hasn't even claimed he's happy.
Yeah. Pretty brutal. You had a conversation with Palmer on core memory. And one of the things that's interesting to me about Palmer is that I feel like this is a very gut feel thing for me. But if I think about all the other leaders out there, to me, he's the most Elon-esque in a lot of different ways. The way he carries himself, the way he thinks about his business, the way he's at the cutting edge of engineering, maybe not like across, you know, he did the headset thing with Meta, with Facebook at the time. Then he started, you know, he went into weapons and sort of brought some of that VR technology with him. So he's not across the horizontals as Elon is. But like the way he approaches his business running is really interesting. He did a podcast with, Peter Diamandis, I think, on his podcast. Yeah, he said something.
And another really good one with Sean Ryan, too.
Of course,
those conversations.
The one with core memory.
Yep.
Is the best.
Of course.
The best one.
Core memory, the best one with Palmer by far, right there. But the one thing he said on that pod, which was like very eye-opening to me, he's like, okay, well, I have all these investors, right? And if I start feeling like the investors that are in my company are not aligned with what we want to get done, I need to start saying some crazy shit so they sell. And then people that are actually on board with the mission buy so that we have less friction to get to where we're going. And I'm like, wow, that I never thought about that before. And that is nuts. And then I think about how Elon sometimes goes off the rocker, you know, quote unquote. And I'm like, I'm like viewing it through the skeptical sense, like a skeptical lens. I'm like, okay, how much of this are you just trying? Are you just trying to shed like the people that are not on your side that want Tesla to go somewhere, SpaceX, et cetera, and not these are just repeating exercises, that's, you know, or whatever. But I'm really curious to get your take on Palmer, because to me, you know, I don't think we have another person. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm not looking deep enough, probably not nearly deep enough, but it doesn't feel like there is sort of like the next Elon anytime soon because of how unique he is. But Palmer to me feels very special. Like what's your sense about that individual?
Yeah, man, he's kind of my favorite person to talk to, really, I think. Gosh,
and the mullet is glorious. Like, I mean, it's like
everything
and the shirts.
Yeah, and the sandals.
everything is like next level with him. He's okay. First of all, he's really easy to talk to. You know, he's got an opinion on everything, but it's not just like an opinion. I mean, he's usually, if you ask him about, like, you know, dolphin sex rituals, I mean, he's got like a PhD in dolphin sex rituals or something. I mean, I don't know if you guys heard on my podcast, but he like sat down, I played like a air horn sound, and he's like, do you know about the horn siren community? I was like, of course, man. Like, this is where we're starting. Tell me the history of
his air YouTube horn. Algorithm must be a mess.
You know, but he's like that. I went to his house once and this is what I like about him, is that he's like hands-on, right? Like in his kitchen. This was before the Mod Retro, that he has this Game Boy device that he's kind of remade, and he's made like basically an awesome new Game Boy. And there were like the early prototypes of that, like sitting around his kitchen. Like you could tell he was soldering the electronics for it. And so I just appreciated that he actually knows how to do some of this stuff. But yeah, I think he's like, it's interesting, you know, because Elon has so many of these like varied interests, and obviously things keep expanding. I think Palmer actually, you know, if Meta hadn't fired him for being a Republican, I think he would have been quite happy just making VR headsets. Like his whole, I really do think that's kind of like this fundamental part of his soul. And so there's this complexity to him in that he's interested in everything, but there's this simplicity to him where I think he's like a hardcore like nerd teenager at heart and would love to just play Dungeons and Dragons in VR and could find like a happy life in that. I think now that Meta pushed him out and sort of changed his course in life, you know, he takes this defense stuff very seriously. I mean, if Anduril's able to pull off like half of what it is intending to pull off, I mean, he, you know, in the like Hollywood version of Elon or whatever, I think Palmer's probably closer to Tony Stark than like anyone actually, because of the stuff that Anduril's working on. So yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities. I think he's someone who's not afraid clearly to voice his opinion. He sticks by things he believes in. He is not afraid to go against the grain. I'm not sure he gets like his hands on the factory floor or anything like that, at least not yet. But also, he's crazy, man. He flies, I don't know if you guys know this, but like he can fly like Black Hawk helicopters. He owns like 8 helicopters or something like that. He's got, I think he like bought a bunch of retired missile silos and has like little houses set up in there. I mean, he's like a really eccentric, fascinating dude. So I've been following him and like all of Anduril for a couple of years. There's a dude at Anduril everyone should know about, this guy Matt Grimm. He's like one of the 4 co-founders, and that dude does not get enough attention, but he, which is sort of by design, he's a little less of like a public seeking type figure. But, you know, when you look at stuff like the Arsenal One factory in Ohio, not only like finding the site, but getting it off the ground, or pretty much like any of Anduril's factories, it's usually Matt who's doing a lot of the work to make that happen. And so Anduril kind of has this, sorry, this is a long-winded way of saying, I think Anduril has these four co-founders, and where maybe like Elon has a lot of these qualities, like Trey Stevens is really good at raising money. Brian, the CEO, is very politically adept and like a good leader, you know, and Palmer's your crazy ideas man, and Matt's kind of your executor, right? So they have these different functions taken care of at a high level by a group.
One of the things I'm curious about is for the next 20 years, like your Palmers, your Elons, your Jensens, right? Like these kind of folks are going to have, seems like they're going to have outsized impact on where we're going to go as a civilization, at least from a business perspective, right? I think
and I might even throw Alex Karp in there too. I know we haven't really talked about any Palantir related subjects so far, but yeah.
I agree 100%. It's so like Elon, Jensen, Karp, Palmer, maybe a little bit earlier on the path, but he just seems like too much of a unique individual. These four are, it seemed like at the forefront with maybe others. Who are some of the other people from your perspective, Ashley, that you feel like, you know, these people seem primed to really like shape civilization in the next couple of decades that perhaps they're not getting the attention they deserve? Or they're sort of flying under the radar. How do you have any names you'd like to throw out there?
Yeah, that's interesting, man. I mean, I don't know if this count, though, this definitely doesn't count as flying under the radar, but just slightly to the side of the group you mentioned. I mean, clearly, if like one of these AI companies is sort of like reaches an escape velocity beyond the others, then Sam Altman, Dario from Anthropic, or Demis from DeepMind, you know, they may end up having the most outsized influence of them all. I mean, if we end up with one true AI overlord, that would be a huge impact. This is going to be unsatisfying because I don't have a name to put behind it, but I fully suspect somebody will create a new computer that has AI at its core that finally moves us beyond the like 1980s interface we all have on our laptops and the iPhone interface we have on our phones. There will be a new computing hardware company at some point, and whoever that is will be a billionaire personally and a multi-trillion dollar company, whoever can really make use of the software that's coming. I think biotech obviously is this field that I'm super interested in. It always seems to take longer and be harder than people think. I would just say has a lot of work to do, but there's this guy, Jacob Kimmel, at a company called New Limit. He's like about as impressive as it gets, and they are on the hunt. They're on the cusp. It's early days, but they're doing longevity stuff, reprogramming the body's cells, basically finding ways to take like your liver back to its 25-year-old state, your brain back to its 25-year-old state. And Jacob is, I don't know, is like, I've done this for a long time. I remember there's like a handful of people I've sat in the room with, and I was kind of like, it happened with the Collison brothers. It happened with Peter Beck. It happened with Diane Greene from VMware. And I just have that feeling about Jacob Kimmel as well. It's just kind of like, I don't know if exactly what you do is going to pan out, but you're going to pan out. you know, I expect the Collison brothers actually probably have, my bet is they just have a ever growing impact on the way the world's money moves around and works. Are probably the smartest, maybe like highest integrity people I've run across in a long time.
These are the guys from Stripe, right?
From Stripe, yeah, sorry. Yes, yeah, from Stripe. Not that they need that much help. They're doing quite well, but I suspect we'll only do better and better in the world. Yeah, I'm trying to think who else, man. Who else like really jumps out?
Kind of noodling on that in the background, what's your take on Zuck? Like, he is one of these people that's so easy to kind of write off as having reached his limit. And I was just very struck by his ability to patch things up with Palmer. And I mean, if Palmer is going to allow him back into his good graces, I just don't know what that means.
Wow. I think it means Sack wants to do business with the Trump administration is what I think it means. I think, like, Zuck's pretty fascinating. I was never into Facebook. I've crapped on them for years and years and years. That's sort of like, you know, the core Facebook Meta type service. And I think is, you know, it's like, it's kind of like cynical to start with. I think Zuck was like, struck me as, he's obviously very bright. He just struck me as kind of like more simple than less sophisticated than some of these other guys. You have to give him credit for something like, as far as somebody willing to, okay, he wants to make his mark on the world. I think obviously he doesn't think Meta is the thing he wants his legacy to be in terms of like the social networking site and Instagram and things like that. He wants to be the person that creates something like that new computer that changes the world and is a competitive guy and is clearly like investing tons of money to try to make that happen. I give him, he's way more interesting now than he used to be because I think the VR stuff is interesting. I think their brain computer interface stuff, like he's trying to find new ways to manipulate computers with your mind instead of, you know, just using a mouse. And so anyway, you know, and is like a counterpuncher on the AI stuff. And so way more interesting than he used to be. I don't know if that comes from like the same place where some of the other people we've been talking about, where it comes from. I think Zuck's kind of competitive and wants to be seen as having that achievement, but I do give him credit. I think the Palmer stuff is all very, you know, okay, sorry. That also has two parts to it. I do think the stuff where like Zuck seems to have found his patriotic streak appears genuine, you know, like he kind of went after it harder than other folks before it was as normal or a popular thing to do. He's riding around with his American flag. I think that part is genuine. I think the butting up with Palmer and trying to use Palmer's connections to kind of get deeper into the Republican world is more of like a business play that is more Machiavellian, I guess, and just practical.
Got it. Hans, you mentioned initially Karp and Palantir. I want to make sure if you have anything there that you bring it to the front.
Well, I didn't know. We just hadn't talked about them. Is there anything that you would like to share on them and their journey?
It's a super fascinating company too. So I wrote the first ever long magazine story on Palantir like many, many, many years ago. And it was pretty funny. I remember I worked in Palo Alto and, you know, all of a sudden just going to get coffee and like all these dudes with like buds in their ears are waiting in line, getting coffee, like clearly sort of burly security types. And I was like, what? It's so like not Palo Alto, you know, it's just like this suburban place near Stanford. I was very low key and all of a sudden these dudes are showing up. And so I started asking some friends. They're like, oh yeah, it's this company Palantir. They're doing some weird shit, you know, on some military stuff and everything. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm interested in that. And then I go meet Karp and he's like a maniac, man. I mean, he's like a philosophy professor running this defense company. He's like kind of sounds like a Democrat, but like everything about the company looks, you know, hardcore sort of Republican conservative leanings. Really hard to wrap my head around. I'd known Peter Thiel for a long time, so I'm starting to talk to him about the intellectual. I was like, clearly this has the trappings of some kind of civil liberties violations all over. He's like, no, you don't understand. Like the better we make this, actually the more freedoms you have. And I was like, is that true? I don't know. Okay. You're trying to think that through. And so I got interested in the company. Sham, who's like the number two at Palantir. I mean, he was like a young kid. You know, he's so, I don't know if people see him now. He's so polished and this like sophisticated executive. I mean, he was more close to like a dorky engineer back then. So it's been funny to like sort of see him evolve. But yeah, I mean, Carp's fascinating, right? I never actually would have guessed that. I think I wrote that story, I don't know, must have been almost like 10 or 12 or 13 years ago. He seemed like one of those guys where this, I thought it was like a hobby, or he had just sort of like accidentally become the CEO and he would do this for a couple of years and somebody else would take it over. And so to see him still there, still with this like religious passion for all this, is fascinating. As far as I can tell, on the software side of what they do, I just don't see anyone competing tremendously well against them, especially not from the traditional sort of military consultant type world. And so, yeah, anyways, long way of saying just still remains a super fascinating company, obviously like crazy conviction on what they want to do. So very focused. Yeah. They're funny. I see like the Brits, you know, complaining about them and their involvement in the NHS healthcare system and everything. It's just, I mean, it's like, I kind of get it because it's like, oh, Palantir is coming to your medical information. On the other hand, I'm just like, do you guys want this stuff to like work or not, man? I mean, are you actually happy with what it's like now? I don't know. I find people, I understand like sort of the skepticism and some of the hatred for big tech, but I also get baffled by people who cannot like even fathom the idea that maybe this is like progress and things can get better, and all these people are not trying to just you know, take over your lives. I total random aside, I find so much of the discourse ridiculous. It's like we all have a smartphone in our pocket with GPS that tracks us everywhere we go. We let like Apple and Google read all our emails. You know, we've got microphones, speakers, cameras, and then like the stuff that we actually end up worrying about. I'm like, well, whatever you're concerned about, I think you made that trade-off a long time ago. Maybe we should move on and talk about something else, because you know, if you have a cell phone, you're pretty much done.
Yeah, I'll take this opportunity to crap on Jason from the All In podcast when he's like, hey, we need these AI pendants to have little red lights on them so that people know when they're recording. It's like, dude, do you have a cell phone in your pocket? Like, we crossed that bridge, oh, I don't know, like 15 years ago?
It's like, I don't understand, man. I mean, people pretend like we don't have this or something. It's like, I'm not even sure I was like happy about it, but I have an Android. I mean, Google... like Google knows more about me than I know about me, you know, and whatever the hell Palantir is doing, something seems irrelevant to me. I don't know.
Shout out J-Cal. I think the, I do think what I'm noticing in public discourse now, like this is the sort of the tone of it, especially as, you know, the artificial intelligence stuff's coming, you know, becoming, it's a train that can't be stopped, and it's becoming obvious that's the case. Palantir is becoming a sort of more mainstream story, you know, with the New York Times coverage, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're a $250, $300 billion company, whatever they are now. So Carp is no longer this like weirdo eccentrics, lunatic philosophy professor. It's like now he's the CEO of one of the most valuable companies in the world, right? But what I'm noticing is, like, and the other thing is like Elon's involvement with Doge, et cetera, et cetera. Like competence is somehow becoming a Trojan horse for like dictatorship or authoritarianism or surveillance. And that's one of the tones I'm hearing. It's like, well, you know, one of the things about our broken system right now and everything, like a lot of things not working, is that the nice thing you have with that is that, well, at least you're not giving all this data and information to these companies that are going to screw you over, right? But then the alternative viewpoint is like, okay, well, then you just don't want anything to get better. Right. And does better necessarily mean actually giving up your freedoms? Right. Does it actually mean giving up a piece of your soul or whatever to get a better life, to get more competency, to get better results? How do you grapple with that in this day and age?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts, I guess. You know, if you dial back, okay, let's go back to like, I don't know. Well, so call it like since the rise of the consumer internet, 1995, 1996. I think the mega trend is that the nerds have inherited the earth, right? The richest people in the world are engineers. That's like where we've ended up. And what's going to happen when that happens? Well, you're going to like have a world that is trying to run more smoothly and like have kinks worked out and function. And, you know, I think that's just like, that's the reality. You can not want it to be that way, but it's pretty, the ship has sailed on that one too. And so, you know, I think that vibe runs counter to like the way a lot of people want to live their lives. I mean, which is understandable. We don't all want to be like maximized and have, you know, a world that operates like that. So I kind of get that, but it's this like assumption of evil. I don't know. I actually saw Scott Galloway last night on, I think, Piers Morgan's show. And he was saying, you know, kind of your argument a little bit was, he's saying, oh, all these people wrap themselves in like a cloak of competency to, and then try to excuse their abhorrent behavior everywhere else. And so, yeah, sort of saying like, hey, make stuff run better. I might be a jerk and a terrible person, but the world's going to function better. I don't even understand what the alternative is. It's like, what are we saying that like Washington is otherwise full of like really upstanding moral people who were setting like a great example before? Exactly. I'm so confused as to like what the apparent option is. I mean, I would love it if there was some, you know, sort of semi-competent, you know, perfect person running this stuff. As far as I can tell, the people in Washington are like even worse. I'm not sure I understand the end goal. I mean, look, we all like go on a vacation and sit on a mountaintop and it feels good and you're relaxed and you're not, phones not dinging all the time, and the world we live in is getting faster and faster and more engineered and all of that. So, you know, I get some like parts of where this yearning comes from. I think whatever this thing is, where we just assume that like every tech person is a horrendous scumbag, you know, evil. It just seems so simple that, yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me.
I do just want to specifically thank you for your reporting on the tech industry from that perspective that doesn't accept that stupid, silly frame, because that is like 90% of the reporting coverage on tech, and it makes it so both uninformative, like it legitimately makes you stupider on these topics, and yeah, super unhelpful.
I think, yeah, somewhere we like crossed, it's like, I understand you want to question powerful people and try to get the world going the right way. But like, I used to work in the New York Times. I swear to God, they would not let us write like some of this, like huge chunks of what they write. It's like clearly activism to me. I mean, it's like on news stories, you are trying to get a point across. And I know all these people. I mean, they're kind of like, they're my friends. They like hate tech. It's like, why cover this? Go write about sports or something. I don't know, man. Just do something else. It's like, why be miserable all the time?
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, ultimately, this is the forcing function here for these technologies to exist, is that there's demand for them. You know, it's like, that's ultimately, if we get to a point where the population of the planet, when humans, you know, are like, well, you know what? I don't want to be on my phone. I want to go to the mountain. I don't want to do this. I want to do this instead. I don't want to get into a self-driving car that's going to cost much less. I want to be in control. Like, and so like those market forces will start moving the businesses to be reactive to those demands, right? That's how the market works. As long as we're not, and this is sort of like another philosophical question, or I guess, you know, question about governance, is like, okay, so then like how much do you want the government to be part of that, those levers? How much do you want to be, you know, we want government to dictate like what's good or bad for the human, right? And I feel like a lot of what's going on right now, a lot of the anti sort of like tech movement or AI movement, is that you have folks that are just trying to shape the world in the vision that they think people want that world to look like, instead of allowing people to make decisions for themselves. And that's the overarching trend that I've seen that is starting to be muted a little bit, but it's like, as and one of my big fears, I talked about this with a podcast a couple of days ago with Andrea James, is, I don't know if you saw this chart from on X. It was like the people who found some sort of justification for the murder of Trump and Elon was like 30% or something.
Okay, no,
from like 2 to 7. So like 60 to 70% of the population was like, there's zero justification for the murder of Elon Musk and or Donald Trump. And then there was a, from 2 to 7, it's like 2 is tiny bit of justification, to 7 to like absolute total justification. From 2 to 7 was like 30% of the population was like, I can kind of see if they get murdered, you know, Trump is blah, 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 Elon's blah, blah, blah. So I'm thinking about that, the subset. And then I'm like, okay, what's the subset going to be like as AI comes through and it inevitably displaces some jobs, but also creates others? Of the ones that are going to have a tough time transitioning, how many of them hold that worldview? And how much is that going to cause chaos as this new generation of technology comes through? And then the folks that have been fed this sort of rhetoric, that's like, the world that's coming, it's not for you, basically, right? I have a lot of anxiety around that. So you tell me if my conspiracy corner is my tinfoil hat too put on too hard, or do you think there's some legitimate concerns there?
It's a hard question to answer because I go back and forth.
Come on, Ashley, you got poor memory. Come on, bro.
It's mostly around how I think like AI is going to roll out, because I keep oscillating back and forth based on the day. But I don't know, man. You know, there's a world where most likely it's kind of like the a bunch of white collar jobs that go first, with people who paid a ton of money for their education and were expecting to have nice, comfortable lives. And I don't know. Do you think those people have the gumption? Do you think they have the energy to like start a revolution, or are they too fat and happy to mobilize? Yeah.
That's fair.
Who's in that percentage you were talking about? I'm not sure. Cause I think stereotypically when you're thinking about like populist uprisings or something like that, you know, it's usually from the lower classes, and I don't know. I don't know if those jobs are going first this time.
I think that's a very interesting viewpoint. And I've thought about that too, because it's, you know, when I use VO3 as an example, Google Flow's VO3, their new video model, which is like ridiculous. This is basically a B-roll creator on steroids. It's unbelievable. I'm like, oh yeah, no, okay. So another 12 months of this, yeah, a lot of folks that are in, you know, design and editing, et cetera, like, no, they're going to be disrupted heavily. The top 20% that embrace that technology and like multiply their capabilities, they're going to go through the roof. And the bottom 80% that doesn't quite know how to fit into this, they're going to be heavily disrupted or displaced by it. And they're going to have to figure out how to work themselves into this, right? That's kind of how I'm thinking about it. But it's like, okay, so like, if that's where it's starting, you know, your radiologists, maybe your pharmacists, et cetera, your managers, whatever, you know, the developers, I could totally see that outcome. And maybe the transition is not going to be as brutal or as sort of like, it won't take the bottom out. And that's my big fear. Yeah.
It depends on how long the Tesla Optimus project big humanoid robot thing takes in general. But I do think that project is such a big, hairy problem that I think a lot of people are a little bit over optimistic on timelines of when, you know, you're going to have that thing really, really, really start to displace labor physically.
The robotic stuff always takes longer. I have a question I've been battling with. So I have an AI admin. And you know, often it ends up, I hope this doesn't sound super callous, I actually mean this from a genuine place. Sometimes, you know, it ends up, well, it usually ends up in conversations with like human admins. And am I like a jerk? I was like sitting there last night wrestling with this. Are you like a jerk to like send this out into the world? And then like the human has to kind of, it's like talking to this thing, and like I'm sure some of these people at some point must be like, oh, this just did like what I usually do, and then, you know, thoughts must go off. I like, if somebody was coming to me, just obviously these LLMs write stuff, but if somebody was just like like if it was just right in my face that I was being replaced. Yeah, I don't know. Now last night I was like, ah, I'm a jerk, man.
I have a lot of thoughts about this. I have a lot. You want to go, Hans, or you want me to go?
I was just going to say core memory, just for igniting existential dread in the administrative class.
I mean, I will tell you, like, one of the big quests that I'm on. So our little team. So Hans, myself, Larry, David, Alyssa, who's a newcomer on our team, but my big initiative for the next 12 months is I want to adopt artificial intelligence in every imaginable nook and cranny of my organization, because if I don't, I'm going to be left in the dust. That's just the fact, right? So if I don't embrace whatever I'm trying to do is either going to be a significantly smaller percentage of what it could be, right? To the point where I risk whatever I'm building to become completely insignificant, because I'm not going to be able to keep up. Now, the other part of this that I'm also keeping in mind is that the uniqueness of what we're building has to be human. It has to be human. Otherwise, it just becomes a permutation of the artificial intelligence. I think I think there is going to be demand, you know, like supply demand dynamics. What are the things that are most valuable? They're typically the things that are most scarce. You know, like real estate, gold, stuff like this, right? Like, you know, things that you can't, diamonds artificially, right? Because they can make them in the lab now, but whatever. Scarcity drives high value products typically. And so art is a perfect example. So in a world where AI and robotics will be limited by the manufacturing and the compute, you know, basically meaning that the cap for AI creation is a million times higher than human creation, because then we're limited by how many babies we have and how much we want to put this to work, right? Which is limited by how much we sleep and how much we eat and et cetera, and how much we're willing to engage. In theory, that should increase the value of human creation or whatever that means, right? But AI just becomes a tool or some sort of underlying foundation to get that human thing to reach or be millions of times better. That's the way I conceptualize it. But that by default means that you have to embrace artificial intelligence fully, whatever that means, right? So that's my high level conceptualization of what this could be. But I don't know if you agree with that. I would love to hear your thoughts, because I'm sure you're facing this too with what you're building. Is like, how much, I'm sure one of the questions you have is like, how much do I get AI involved in what I'm trying to build, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's like obvious, well, yeah, I mean, there's obvious places for me, sort of more difficult ones for some of the employees and stuff. But yeah, you know, we go off and shoot this TV show and just bringing the footage back and organizing it. And it's like this huge nightmare. And I already see like a couple genius kids from the University of Waterloo seem to be spinning up like a AI version of an assistant editor, more or less, you know. Man, I mean, if that worked well, I would without too much guilt move over to that very, very quickly. I like to believe what you're saying about the creators, because for many obvious reasons, I mean, my working assumption is that most of my work takes place away from a desk. Like if you read my books, you know, most of the, especially the valuable information, is not available on the internet. Like I've got out into the world to acquire this. I've used my personality to convince someone to talk to me and reveal things. And so I like to believe that that keeps me employed for quite some time. Because yeah, I think you'd have to have an optimist that was charming and genial and persuasive to pull all that off.
Or good at pillow talk.
Right. Just, you know, yes, a good, interesting being out in the world, however it uses its wiles. But so on those parts, I like to believe that. I don't know. I've been working on a book on OpenAI, and then, you know, sometimes I'm just sitting in the room with these researchers and they're like, you know, well, you might as well publish this in 8 months, because if you don't, it's just pointless after that. You're like, God, is that true, man? And they seem so smart and like relatively grounded. It's not even like they fully want this to happen. They just know it's going to happen. And so my brain keeps getting warped as to like exactly which timeline we're on and how all this plays out. But I get your point. I want to embrace AI, I'm definitely not going to shy away from it. I would try to use it everywhere I can. I do feel like a jerk still when my admin is like,
yeah.
I mean, there's an obvious part of this, right? Whereas like the best admins are not just like filling out your calendar. They like know you and are making you a better version of yourself. I don't know that I can really like afford somebody like that. So my AI admin is kind of doing what I need it to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, man. It is sort of like a scary thought for me too. I do wonder though, it's like, will the demand for the real person, is that like, is authenticity,
yeah,
honesty, is that, that has, is that what people will value, right?
That has to be. It's at least for a while, right? Yeah, it has to be. I mean,
it's
maybe
like the Joe Rogan effect on steroids, basically.
Yeah, like maybe at some point it gets so good and it's gone on for so long, we're like a nerd to all this. But I would think that that's like, if you think about the doctor, I mean, because I had a thing with my wife recently where the AI was actually giving us like better information than our fancy doctors at fancy hospitals. But it's like, you still want a human with a bedside manner to deliver that to you. I actually got like kind of torn on this because the AI would spend like infinite time with us answering our questions. Whereas when you're with the doctor, you have this 20 minute window. And then a second you walk out, you're like, oh, I forgot to ask all these things. And then they get them back on the phone is really hard. Whereas the AI was just like sitting there pounding away, you know, and getting everything. So, but you kind of feel like you want a human to be the one who's telling you you're going to die, or giving you the pep talk on how they're going to fix you. But then what is that? Is that just mean you want like the most charming doctors, you know, is that the doctor skill? Somebody who has enough knowledge, but just they have the best bedside manner, and I don't know what you end up desiring.
I mean, that's it's interesting, right? Because in that situation, the thing that the humans probably looking for most is comfort, looking for empathy, looking for love, looking for support. That's probably a lot harder to emulate, especially just with text-based stuff. It's very cold. Now, it might be factual, way more factual. It might be correct. So that has a ton of value. But it is interesting sort of what you're talking about is like, okay, in that situation, it's not really the doctor's ability to understand what's wrong with you. Is their ability to be there emotionally with you when they deliver that message, right? And that's
right. Yeah.
Humanness is so valuable.
Well, especially, I mean, I know that ChatGPT and all these things, like they can be really good at being patient and like understanding and, maybe in the customer service realm, better at all those things than a human. But for the medical context, you know, having that conversation with someone else who can also die, like there is that missing element of what empathy means in that situation.
Almost spirituality in a sense. It's almost like it opens this door for spirituality to come in and for humans to start connecting more on a spiritual basis.
I mean, it would be cool if we end up like, we really end up in some, the robots and the AIs are tending to all our needs. And then we spend the next like 1,000 years just fixing all the stuff we've screwed up on the planet and like, you know, actually just having time to like support each other, get to know each other. I don't know. You know, this could be okay.
Sounds too good to be true.
the fixing the planet part, I'm actually like bullish on and kind of down with. I think, yeah, if we had all this,
it's a technical problem. It's an engineering problem.
Well, and people all worry about like, oh, well, what are you going to do? You're not going to have a job. What are you going to focus your attention on? I actually think people get really into that. It's like, oh, well, let's like make our cities perfect. Let's go clean all these green areas, yeah, up. Let's like really dial this thing in. Let's get the animals taken care. You know, there's plenty of stuff for us to do that we've just spent the last 2,000 years messing up. It seems like that's probably hundreds of years of work ahead of us.
Yeah,
and that doesn't even, you know, begin to talk about all the things out in space that we can go explore. And yeah,
100%. I mean, and yeah. I mean, It's like some days I wake up and I think, God, 2 years from now, the world's going to be upside down, 180 degrees. None of us are going to know what to make sense of anything. And then the other times I wake up and I'm like, ah, this is going to be like the internet. It's going to like ooze through society over a couple decades. You're going to kind of wake up and be like, oh, wow, life really is so different to when I was growing up. But like, I'm totally used to this now. And yes, a bunch of jobs went away, but then, oh, all these other jobs were created. I mean, this is like always happens that way. I'm not saying anything novel here, unless AI is just that much different to everything that came before it. Yeah.
I think the best case scenario for it would be the, you know, one of the theses I have is like AI is the maximization of the, is sort of the alignment. Well, I guess not novel either, but like aligning the human, that individual, a specific individual's maximum potential and talent and innate talent with what the world is looking for, with the demand, like the market need. And I feel like artificial intelligence and robotics are going to create a marketplace where those two things actually start finding each other at a much higher rate, which should dramatically improve happiness. It should dramatically improve fulfillment. But for those that can't find that, they're going to see an even bigger gap, because now we've created one side of the spectrum that's happier than they've ever been. But those that don't get that become the saddest they've ever been, because they can see ultimate happiness is prevalent and achievable. Right. Whereas right now, it might be like the quote unquote billionaire millionaire class that maybe the current society looks at now. With artificial intelligence and robotics, you may have it, you might be able to expand that pie to the top 20, 30%, 40%, 50%. But then at that point, you are creating bigger extremes. And in history, when you create bigger extremes, shit gets fucking weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
It gets real weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that idea. But somebody else was saying this is like near your idea, but not. Is a little tangential, but like maybe, you know, I think they run these studies, right, on sort of like the middle class and white collar workers and how people spend their time. And it's like 80% of people with office jobs do like 4 hours of work a week or something. Like there's a chance that we've already been doing universal basic income and sort of like play acting at work for the last like 30 or 40 years, and they're like, this won't be this hard for us to absorb, because we just like still go to the office and like push a spreadsheet to somebody else.
Wow.
And that we've already, I mean, like under that argument, you know, pretty much since Excel was invented or something like that, we kind of been on this course where you like feel productive, but you're actually kind of not, but you're okay with it, right? It's like, I don't know. Yeah. Like in that argument, it's like we're pretty good at fooling ourselves into thinking we have a purpose and all that.
That's fascinating. So it's like businesses in this day and age, they were creating surplus profits, which is going to salaries for people that are being paid for a job where they're only doing 5% of what they've been asked to do, or 10%, but there's a social contract.
It's the Twitter thing. It's the Twitter thing.
Yeah.
And like, look how many employees Apple has, and look how many products they make.
So true.
And then, like, you tell me, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced.
that's a fascinating thought. Listen, I know you got to go, Ashley. Let's make sure we let people know where they can find you. Go for it. The floor is yours.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you guys so much for your time. That was really fun. The best place is probably coremory.com. And then we've got at Ashley Vance on X. And then we got a YouTube channel, which is Core Memory as well. Podcast, Core Memory, everything.
And we'll put links in the description and comments for Ashley's previous work, his excellent book on Elon, so much other stuff. But thank you so much, Ashley, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
All right. That was really fun. You guys are awesome. Thank you.